Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
The Kremlin's view of the war, an exclusive interview with Dmitry Peskov, President Putin's chief spokesperson and close confidant. He spent more than 20 years at the Russian president's side. Then, in a war of information, getting the facts with the Russia investigator for open source intelligence site Bellingcat. Plus,
it is very, very fishy, and I think by keeping it quiet, we haven't done her any favors.
Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post journalist formerly detained in Iran, talks to Hari Srinivasan about the case of the American basketball star Brittany Griner, who has been held in Russian custody since mid-February.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. As the war in Ukraine rages into its fourth week, a huge question remains. What is Russian President Vladimir Putin thinking? What is the end game? If anyone knows, it is my first guest tonight, Dmitry Peskov, who has served as Putin's chief spokesman for more than two decades. And he's been at Putin's side throughout his rise to power. He's a close confidant. It's a relationship that's made him also a high-profile target for Western sanctions. And Dmitry Peskov is joining me now from Moscow for this exclusive interview. Dmitry Peskov, welcome to the program. Can I start by asking you, you know, we're, as I said, nearly 4 weeks into this war. You, by all intelligence, experts, are somewhat stalled, certainly around Kyiv and in other parts. There seems to be low morale amongst your troops. There seems to be equipment breakdowns and command and control issues. My first question is, what does President Putin think he has achieved in Ukraine to date?
Well, first of all, not yet. He hasn't achieved yet, and we're speaking about special military operation that is going on, and it is going on strictly in accordance with the plans and with purposes that were established beforehand. And of course, well, first of all, I think we have to speak about the reasons for this operation. I mean, because speaking about the morale against our amongst our military. Of course, you operate data and information coming from different media and from your intelligence, but you would probably have to doubt this information. You have to doubt it, and you have to think twice whether it is true or not.
Well, here's the thing, Mr. Peskov. You know, intelligence that really predicted the invasion turned out to be true, despite what you all told us, you know, from the Kremlin. So let's just get past that. We've also heard, you know, civilians and journalists who've seen Russian troops and who've recounted. But that's be that as it may, when you say he hasn't achieved, President Putin hasn't achieved yet, what do you foresee? Because this was going to be, according to your own side, in the press, in the state-sponsored media in Russia, a pretty quick operation. It was even suggested that, you know, within a couple of days that, quote-unquote, Ukraine would return to, quote-unquote, Mother Russia. What has gone wrong, and what do you see for the next phase of this?
Well, of course, no one would think from the very beginning about a couple of days. It's a serious operation with serious purposes. And I think if we try to remember those purposes, those main goals of the operation, it's to get rid of the military potential of Ukraine. And actually, this is why our military are targeting only military goals and military objects on the territory of Ukraine, not civil ones. Russian military are not hitting civil aims, civil targets. Number two is to ensure that Ukraine changes from entire Russian center to a neutral country. And in this sense, let's remember that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, actually the neutral status was fixed in a declaration of independence of the country. Number three, to get rid of the nationalist battalions and nationalist regiments who are now opposing Russian troops, who are now trying to cover themselves under the shield of civilians, thus paving a way for civil casualties.
Dmitry,
and also, I beg your pardon, if you let me, and also to ensure that Ukraine acknowledges the fact that Crimea is also an untakeable part of Russia, and that People's Republics of Lugansk and Donetsk are already independent states, that Ukraine actually has lost them after the coup that happened in 2014.
Okay, so basically you are putting and laying out the original demands from President Putin, which I understand seem not to have changed. Let us talk about civilian infrastructure. Look, I know you guys say that you're not targeting civilians, and you've just told me it was a special military operation, which is, I know, what the Kremlin military censorship demands. It is a war and it is an invasion, and we're all watching it all over global television, no matter what you tell your own people. There are so many civilian targets that it's hard to count them right now. And, you know, you may deny it, but even the Chinese, Dmitry, even the Chinese who are your friends, have expressed a very, very deep concern about civilian targets. Let me just read what the foreign ministry has said. It is deeply grieved to see the conflict between Ukraine and Russia and highly concerned about the damage done to civilians. They are very, very concerned. Those are your friends, the Chinese, not weirdo journalists or anybody who's actually watching it with their own eyes and can tell the truth. So the real question is, what is President Putin's strategic goal in blasting the civilian infrastructure of places like Mariupol, which we are watching, turn to smithereens for the last several weeks now? What's the strategic goal?
Well, the strategic goal is to clear up the Mariupol from nationalistic regiments who are there in a heavily covered environment. By the way, they're simply not letting people out from the city, from the town. And this is a problem. Because now we're receiving lots of refugees coming from there, and they simply tell us, they're eyewitnesses. They simply tell us that they were used like a shield. They were used under heavy bombardment, and then those nationalists, they were killing people who would want to leave the city. Now the main goal is to get rid of those bad guys there.
Dmitry, we also have reporters who are quite close to Mariupol, and they are watching because actually some civilians are getting out right now. And they obviously tell a completely different story, that they have been prevented from getting out. And we know that any attempt to establish any kind of humanitarian corridor has collapsed under the weight of Russian shelling, even when you give assurances. There is no food going in. And your own defense ministry said these last few days that only if Mariupol surrenders will they allow food, water, medicine to go in there. I've covered a siege, probably the longest in modern history, the siege of Sarajevo. So I know the playbook very, very well. So the question is, why are they then coming out and telling us that? But also, there are reports that Russia is taking civilians and citizens from Mariupol, taking them over to Russia, and in some cases putting them, you know, way out in the hinterlands and to work, in perhaps work camps, I don't know, but putting them to work.
No, this is not true. This is not true. It's a fake. It's a fake. And then believe me, we're all living, not only under the circumstances of military operation. We're living in a severe informational war and war of fakes. And then, you have to know the situation from the outside, from the inside. And it's sometimes very hard to understand what is going on there. If you're journalists, and we're receiving operation there from our military information, and then we know what is being said by the people who are led by those nationalistic regiments to leave the city, and then so it's very desperate stories that they that they're telling us.
Why do you think most Russians who are able to get out of these horrendously besieged areas and horrendously shelled areas, why do you think they're fleeing west? They're trying to get out to other parts of Ukraine and to the west rather than fleeing to Russia if they feel so safe with you. Why do you think that's happening?
Part of them is going eastwards, part of them is going westwards. It's a choice of people. And no one is making any obstacles.
Let me put it this way, then. Let's just say you believe all of this. You've just talked about a disinformation war. Russia is known to have perfected the disinformation war ever since it was the Soviet Union. Russian propaganda is incredibly effective, incredibly effective. Let's just say that your people believe it. Let's just say that they believe all this stuff that you have said as a reason for this war, for this invasion, whatever you call it, special military operation. How then do you square the circle that something like 90% of the Ukrainian people asked believe that they will win and that barely a single one of them has collaborated, has surrendered, has shown anything other than a fierce patriotic fervor to hold on to their country and to hold on to their sovereignty and their Ukraine? Are you surprised? Is the president, President Putin, surprised by that?
Well, first of all, you are mistaken. There are Ukrainians who are collaborating. There are Ukrainians who are in cooperation with our military. There are Ukrainians who would like to avoid any casualties and who are in contact with our military, whether they like it or don't, but they understand, because it was declared that if you don't aim our target our military, if you're not trying to kill them, no one is going to hurt you. We will hurt, but we will hurt those nationalistic nazis. We will hurt nazis, not ordinary people and civil people. It is forbidden to target civil people for our military. So, well, and then partly they are in cooperation with our guys. So you're simply mistaken. And speaking about propaganda, starting from a great school of the Soviet Union, I would say that masterpieces of propaganda that we're witnessing now in the West is a good school for us. And we're not that good pupils. I mean, I can even ask you why, for example, CNN is that single-sided in covering this story.
Well, you lead me then to I wasn't going to get there, but if you would allow, you know, journalists to come into Russia and actually report this in a truthful way rather than heavily military censorship, you know, we would be able to report much more of your side. But let's park that for the moment and let's carry on. President Putin, first and foremost, you have seen it, Dmitry. I know that you're watching international news. I know that you watch it. Whatever the Russian people see, you have seen the Ukrainian people refuse to surrender. Every single time your forces issue an ultimatum, not an invitation, an ultimatum, they simply refuse to surrender. And I'm not talking about troops. I'm talking about old men and women. I'm talking about young people. I'm talking about kids. They just won't surrender. This is something that has surprised and impressed, actually, the whole world. So let me just quickly ask you again, what is the end game? Is it to occupy Ukraine? Can you actually do it with the number of troops that you have? Do you really think that even if you win a battle here or there, that you can win a long war?
Occupation is not among the aims of the operation that were stated.
Right. Okay, well, that's that answer then. Let me ask you again about, we're trying to get to the truth, right, Dmitry? So I'm going to, let me just ask, do you see President Putin often? I mean, you're his spokesperson, we know that you're obviously a close official, close confidant. Do you see him often? When was the last time you saw him?
Well, we are in a contact on a daily basis.
Face-to-face? Sorry, it's just interesting.
Sometimes face-to-face, sometimes on the telephone. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you this question about the Ukrainians, because several analysts are watching, and they have listened to what President Putin has said about Mother Russia, about a fraternal Ukraine, or a Ukraine that actually doesn't exist and has no right to exist. And they're wondering whether the president is getting very angry with the Ukrainians. They're wondering whether there's a sort of a punishment against the Ukrainians being leveled. I spoke with the Finnish president, Sauli Niinistö, who, as you know, has met many times with President Putin. And he described to me what he felt was a sense of growing, hatred is what he said, by President Putin for the Ukrainian people, for the Ukrainian leadership now.
No, he's not angry with Ukrainians. And no one here in Russia is angry with Ukrainians. He's angry with those people in Ukraine who want to be part of NATO and who want to deploy American nuclear missiles on their territory. And he's angry with those people in Ukraine who forbids people to speak Russian in their country, mm-hmm. including those Russians who are living in Ukraine for ages. Mm-hmm. He's angry with those people in Ukraine who carries symbols of nazis on the streets of Kyiv and Lviv. And he's crazy with the, he's angry with the Ukrainians and those people in Ukraine who would want to speak with the world, with Minsk negotiations group, mm-hmm. years and years without implementing any obligations.
Well, look, President Putin tore up the Minsk Accords by deciding to do what he wanted to do. And as you know, President Zelensky has already said several times in the last few weeks that he knows there is no NATO on the table for Ukraine. So all the other things are presumably negotiable, what you've just said about neo-Nazis and signs and language. But you know also that neo-Nazis or ultra-nationalists, which do exist there, are a very, very small group that barely won any percentage in recent elections. So it's kind of a straw man. But you mentioned nuclear. You know better than I do that Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons in 1994 to Russia, and Russia was meant to defend it, according to the agreement in Budapest, not to attack it. But it's President Putin who has put the nuclear card on the table. Can you tell me and tell the world whether you believe President Putin is trying to scare the rest of the world and Ukraine by mentioning the nuclear option? Can you tell me that? And can you tell me that he would never use a nuclear weapon?
Two things. I would disagree with you. Firstly, President Putin was not the one who ruined Minsk Accords.
Okay.
That was Ukrainian side. This is number one. Number two, Ukrainian, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, handed in all the nuclear weapons to the Russian Federation. But unfortunately, in the year of 2022, just a couple of months ago, in Munich conference, President Zelensky started to speak about possibility of generating a nuclear arms on the territory of Ukraine. And most probably you have witnessed that.
Mm-hmm. I was actually there, Dmitry, and I actually interviewed him. And I do remember him saying, look what we have got for giving up our nuclear weapons. And the real issue is now, what do you expect other countries to do when you ask them to give up their nuclear weapons? Because, you know, territorial integrity and sovereignty has been violated. Again, even your friends, the Chinese, have said they respect every nation's territorial integrity and sovereignty, including Ukraine's. Could I quickly ask you, though, I need to ask you this, because the world is afraid, and I want to know whether Putin intends the world to be afraid of the nuclear option. Would he use it?
President Putin intends to make the world listen to and understand our concerns. We've been trying to convey our concerns to the world, to Europe, to the United States, for a couple of decades, but no one would listen to us. And before it is too late, it was a decision to launch a special operation, military operation, to get rid of entire Russia that was created next to our borders.
What? To get rid of Russia?
Anti-Russia. Because Ukraine started to be, it was formed by the Western countries, anti-Russia.
Oh, okay.
This is the problem.
Okay, look, Ukraine is a country, sovereign. It's recognized by the United Nations. It's been around for a very, very long time. But I just want to know, I want to ask you again, is President Putin, because again, the Finnish president said to me that when he asked Putin directly about this, because President Putin has laid that card on the table, President Putin said that if anybody tries to stop him, very bad things will happen. And I want to know whether you are convinced or confident that your boss will not use that option.
Well, we have a concept of domestic security. And, well, it's public. You can read all the reasons for nuclear arms to be used. So if it is an existential threat for our country, then it can be used in accordance with our concept.
Well,
there are no other reasons that were mentioned in that text.
So you are basically saying only an existential threat to your country. I still don't know whether I've got a full answer from you, and I'm just going to assume that President Putin wants to scare the world and keep the world on tenterhooks. What about chemical and biological weapons? The United States has said that they believe that there's intelligence that a frustrated President Putin, lack of progress on the ground, may be preparing to use chemical or even biological weapons against Ukrainian troops, civilians, or its leadership.
Well, unfortunately, we have a very strong reason to believe and a very strong evidence that United States have been developing biolabs programs on the territory of various countries around the Russian Federation, including the territory of Ukraine. And this is quite a sophisticated and quite a dangerous biolab program that was led top secret by American specialists. This is a reality that we're facing.
Well,
and when it comes to biological and chemical weapons, we don't have these weapons anymore. In the year of 2017, if I'm not mistaken, it was destroyed completely in accordance with international agreements.
Dmitry Peskov, the United States and allies completely deny that. Basically, you know, there are no Ukrainian biological weapons laboratories, not near Russia's border, not anywhere, says the UN ambassador. Only public health facilities proudly supported and recognized by the US government, the World Health Organization, and other governments and international institutions. They believe this is part of your disinformation campaign, which confuses issues. Can I ask you the following? Before the invasion, yourself and several other high-ranked Russian officials denied to the whole world that there was going to be anything like this and accused all the rest of the world of being hysterical. In November, you responded yourself saying, such headlines are nothing more than empty, unfounded escalation of tension. Russia poses no threat to anyone. Your EU ambassador, Chizhov, 8 days before the invasion, says, I can assure, as far as Russia is concerned, there will be no attack this Wednesday. There will be no escalation next week or the week after or next month. And your deputy foreign minister, Sergei Ryabkov, shortly after negotiations with the Americans and other side in January, said the following, and here's his soundbite.
I do believe that there is no risk of a larger scale war to start to unfold in Europe or elsewhere. We do not want and will not take any action of aggressive character. We will not attack, strike, invade, quote unquote, whatever, Ukraine.
Dmitry, those are all emphatic denials of any such intention. Very close to the day of the invasion, and as what now turns out to be very accurate intelligence, was telling everybody that this was going to happen. So I guess I can't ask you why the lies, but what I want to ask you is, after all those lies, how do you expect Russia, at the highest levels, to be taken seriously now? What can one believe about what's coming up next and about what you all say about what's next, you know, in terms of negotiations or the situation on the ground?
Well, yes, we have said that. And we have said that hoping that Ukraine will never get prepared for a strike against Donbas. Yes, we have said that, hoping that at the end, there will be a breakthrough in Normandy process, in Normandy format. And but after that, in couple of days, that was perfectly clear for us. That was perfectly clear for our military specialists, that Ukraine was going to launch an offensive against Donbas. That Ukraine, by the way, before the end of the operation, Ukraine have concentrated more than 120,000 military personnel at the border, at the division line. Mm-hmm. And there were clear signs that an offensive was going to start. So this was the reason. This was the reason. Like elsewhere, like everyone in the world, till the last moment, we never wanted to believe. We never wanted to believe that to that grave sense, no one would listen to our concerns. And no one would warn Ukrainians not to do that. No one would push Ukrainians towards the solution within a framework of Normandy process. But no one did that.
Okay. Well, you know, there are all these foreign leaders. We know that both presidents went to France to talk about this. None of the intelligence that we heard suggested any such buildup by Ukrainian forces. In fact, the opposite, with President Zelensky saying, no, it's not going to happen, stay calm. In fact, Western intelligence was concerned there wouldn't even be a defense from Ukraine. They hadn't even been prepared for what was coming their way. Is the president surprised at the level of defense and resistance by the Ukrainian forces?
Well, near the Donbas, actually, the level of resistance in Donbas shows that they were quite well prepared, but they were not well prepared for the defense. They were preparing for offensive operation. Okay. This is the case. All
right. Well, here's the thing. They've held you off for nearly four weeks. Who knows what's going to happen in the future, but you are a much more powerful military. So that constitutes resistance and defense in most understandings of that. Can I finally ask you, Alexei Navalny has been sentenced, I believe, to 9 years in maximum security. People on the streets of Russia have been, you know, hoovered up and detained somewhere in the region of, according to the CIA, some 14 to 15,000 Russians. You have prevented independent news organizations from calling it a war, from describing anything about it. Other than the defense ministry line and the Kremlin line. My question is, what are you so afraid of? Of Navalny, of journalists, of the truth? What is there to fear?
No. Well, Navalny is a prisoner. He's a prisoner. He had his first sentence. Now he's got his second one, and he's blamed, and it is proven by the prosecutor's office that he's blamed for fraud. So it's purely economical crime. He was collecting money by his foundation from citizens, regular citizens of Russia and also from abroad. And he was spending part of that money for his personal purposes. This is a fraud in our country, and he was supposed to be punished. And no one is afraid of him. If people is a criminal, he should be in prison. This is the same thing that is happening in the United States and in European countries.
I know you say that. I know the prosecution says that. But the people who allegedly claimed that he was taking their money and using it for himself, then said on the stand that they had been forced to make those testimonies. So listen, Dmitry Peskov, I appreciate you being with us. It gives us something of an understanding from your side. And I hope we can continue the conversation as we watch this war unfold. Thank you so much.
I would be pleased to do that.
My next guest is one of the leaders of the open source investigative organization known as Bellingcat. The site gathers and verifies information from public data to find things that others don't often miss, rather. You may recall their work in Syria, where they uncovered evidence of chemical weapons attacks by President Assad against his own people. And now they're tirelessly working to track, verify, or debunk information surrounding the war in Ukraine. Christo Grozev is Bellingcat's executive director and lead Russia investigator, and he's joining me now. Christo, welcome to the program. Obviously, Russia is what you work on most, and particularly now. What would you say you got from my conversation with Dmitry Peskov right now about what's going on the ground?
Well, first thing I got is that you have extreme patience, and I admire you. I would not have been able to sustain that conversation. But what I understand is that Mr. Peskov is probably not really aware of what Russia's strategy is and what Russia's revised strategy after the initial failures is, because his answers did not make any sense. And I do think that that reflects a broader understanding of that only a very small group of people close to Putin, most militarized Silviks or power elite, are aware of what he thinks. And probably that does not extend to Mr. Peskov. But what we do is we try to track the evidence of war crimes or evidence of civilian harm. We focused nearly 100% of Bellingcat's activity since the start of the war into that. We sometimes divert into debunking the random claim that Russia puts out or Ukraine puts out, regardless which country puts forward unsupported claims. But essentially, all of our efforts are currently focused on chronicling, logging, and preserving for judicial investigations evidence of civilian harm. So that's what we do now.
So let me, before I get to those details, can I just ask you whether you also see what American intelligence seems to be seeing? They say somewhere, you know, between 7 and maybe 9,000 Russian soldiers have been killed. They're also suggesting that a number of generals have been killed. Are you able at all to open source or geolocate any of that?
This is not our main activity. We did start at the beginning tracking casualties on the Russian side, but we have to focus fully on tracking civilian harm. The numbers that are put forward by the Ukrainian side, which is about 12,500, are a bit high based on what we see. We do see numbers that are more in the 8,000 to 10,000 range. And we understand that domestically within the Russian military command, they're also acknowledging about 5,000 deaths at this point. This comes from several sources inside Russia to us. And I do think that 8,000 to 9,000 is the right number at this point.
Can you talk to me about the civilian targeting? I mean, the Russians are absolutely clear in everything they tell the world. We do not target civilian infrastructure. And yet we see before our eyes what's happened to Mariupol, what civilian targets are hit in other cities, including in Kyiv, and, you know, the number of dead and wounded. But there's a very sophisticated way that they have of saying, well, this person is a fake and that person is a fake and it was all actors and it was all staged. Can you get beyond that, given that there's not many independent journalists in Mariupol?
We try to. So far, we've gathered more than 400 incidents of civilian harm. Of those, about 10%, 40 of them represent egregious civilian harm incidents, which could have been prevented, should have been prevented with due care and compliance with military rules of engagement. What we're seeing here is a neglect on the Russian side of the traditional military rules of engagement that are meant to avoid civilian casualties. Every war will have collateral damage of civilian casualties. What is particular here is that the Russian side does not make the effort. And one may believe that actually is part of their strategy to terrorize the population in order for pressure to build up on the government to come to some sort of a compromise with Kremlin. But what we see is not only evidence of targets that have zero military infrastructure importance, such as schools, hospitals, and theaters, as we have seen recently, administrative buildings, but we also see some explanation for why that is happening. There are a lot of intercepted phone calls that are being published by the Ukrainian security services, and we were able to verify a small portion of that, the ones where they publish also the phone numbers of the calling parties. And we hear a lot of Russian officers and soldiers talking to their loved ones in Russia, complaining about the plight that they're in, and actually informing their wives or their spouses that they've been given instructions to ignore the duty of care to civilians, to actually not even pay attention to whom they're shooting as long as somebody's in their line of view. And this would explain also the total neglect for civilian casualties when artillery or other missile shelling is implemented.
Well, that is quite extraordinary information to be able to have. Just very briefly and finally, you did a lot of investigation, Bellingcat did, in Syria, and you saw the pattern. Are we seeing some of the same pattern now?
Yes, we're seeing a pattern of, well, first of all, disinformation and continuous industrial scale fabrication of fakes. What we're seeing is a slightly different direction of the fakes coming from the Russian government. They're mostly meant for a domestic audience. They kind of have given up on trying to convince the world. And they did make some ludicrous claims, such as the Russian ambassador to the Netherlands showed up on a program on Dutch TV and claimed that the two different women who were victims in the Mariupol maternity hospital, one of whom died, he showed the photographs of these completely two different women and claimed that both of them are a crisis actor, the same one at that. So they're doing some ill-advised international attempts, but most of this information is targeting a domestic audience. What we see is also terrorizing civilian areas that have a particular emotional effect, such as hospitals, and I think that may be part of the strategy to terrorize the population as opposed to an incident.
Thank you so much for being with us, Christo Groza. Thank you very much, Bellingcat. Too often, ordinary citizens get caught up in the day's geopolitical dramas. Take the recently released Anglo-Iranian aid worker, Nazanin Zaghari-Ratcliffe, who was held for 6 years by Tehran, and the American basketball star, Brittany Griner, who's being detained right now in Russia since its war on Ukraine, rather a little bit before. Our next guest has experienced these cruel tactics firsthand. Jason Rezaian writes for the Washington Post Global Opinions, and while serving as the paper's correspondent in Tehran, he spent 544 days unjustly imprisoned on trumped-up charges by Iranian authorities. And here he is with Hari Srinivasan discussing how to help those who are too often used as bargaining chips.
Christiane, thanks. Jason Rezaian, thanks so much for joining us. You've got a unique perspective on this. I want to talk a little bit about Brittany Griner. I mean, we're talking about quite possibly the best basketball player out there. She's a phenomenal athlete. And you wrote recently, Jason, that you are really concerned for her and her detention in Russia. How come?
Well, thanks for having me on, Hari, and asking these questions. I think first, the red flag for me was that this arrest was announced through Russian media, state media. We can call it propaganda. I think that's fair to say, with a mugshot. That announcement through their media was made a couple of weeks after her arrest. Then we learned that she was being denied consular access to officials from U.S. government, whose job it is to tend to the needs of Americans in trouble abroad. Whether there's any credibility or truth to charges against her, she has those rights. And the fact that those two things were our initial sort of understanding of the situation were red flags for me. I've been following cases of other Americans detained abroad since my own detention in Iran. And this one leapt out at me as being problematic from the get-go.
So for people who might not understand, why was this WNBA player in Russia in the first place?
So Brittany Griner is one of the greatest basketball players of all time, probably, as you noted, the best or one of the best in the WNBA. But many WNBA players who have the opportunity to play in a foreign league during the offseason do so to earn another income. The contracts that we hear about from NBA or Major League Baseball or NFL, astronomical numbers in the tens of millions, are unfortunately not available to WNBA players. And so, you know, those like Brittany Griner who have these immense talents seek an opportunity to you know, have financial gain, and they do that in other countries, Russia being one of the leading ones.
So she's out there, basically a second job to make ends meet, so to speak, but and to keep playing. And she's detained in Russia right now. And I wonder if this is just a semantic difference. What is the difference between kind of a pretrial detention on whatever charges they think she's guilty of versus basically being held hostage?
I think that there are very subtle differences. But when you talk about a pretrial detention in a country like Russia, in a country like Iran, in a country like China, where we know that the judicial processes that a lot of people and often usually foreign people go through are not, similar to the ones that we know in the West, where due process is a right that's guaranteed to all. One wonders very quickly, what are the motivations here? So to me, as someone who's been through this, the idea of a pretrial detention is more to explain to the Russian public why this superstar is being held for an extended period of time. What is there to investigate, right? She arrived on an airplane, her bags were searched, there either was a substance in there or there wasn't. Why do we need to wait another 2 months while she's being kept held incommunicado, unable to speak to representatives of the U.S. government? It is very, very fishy. And I think by keeping it quiet, we haven't done her any favors.
Forgive me for sort of minimizing this, but it seems like these human beings are just pawns in a much larger, you know, game. This is just table stakes. Well, I've got two of yours. You've got two of mine. You want to talk about this? Let's get this other thing over with. And the higher profile person that I have, maybe it's worth more in my stack of chips. I mean, again, I don't want to, you know, belittle it to a card game, but it just seems
like what it is, Hari, that, you know, you've put it very well. And my deep concern is that with 40 something Americans being held in this way right now, the State Department is spread very thin in trying to work these cases and bring people home. What happens when that number becomes 100, 200, 400? My concern is that at that point, the U.S. government throws up its hands and says, you know, this is not an issue that we can get a handle on. Travel beyond our borders at your own risk. That's not the future that I want to live in. And I think that that's the direction that we're headed. If we don't come to a consensus with our allies first and then create credible deterrence to the hostage taking nations, so that they understand that the cost of doing this it is going to be higher than the perceived benefits.
You have looked into this and you have created a documentary at the Washington Post, which was fascinating, called Bring Them Home. And it looks not at the Brittany Griner case, but you actually look at the case of a single family and talk about how this is actually happening to multiple people.
We haven't heard from Ahmad for 12 days, you just kind of start thinking a bunch of stuff.
And one of the facts that really leapt out at me was that there are now more Americans being detained by countries or state actors than there are by terrorist organizations. And that was just, you know, floored me. I had no idea.
It's astounding. And I think it's important to note that there are probably thousands of Americans being held on credible charges of legal violations in different countries, or at least charges that might be credible, that are not, you know, put into the category of wrongful detainees. wrongful detainees is a determination that the U.S. government makes about Americans who are being held by foreign states in situations that clearly either are politically motivated or motivated by trying to extract leverages from the United States. We identified about 43 of cases of that. There were four cases of Americans being held by terrorist organizations. It's a stark difference that has shifted over time. And my colleagues at Washington Post Opinions and I, as we looked at this phenomena through the lens of this individual family, the Shargi family, whose father, husband, Ahmad Shargi, is being held in Iran right now, we started to understand that the U.S. government doesn't have a great approach to dealing with this problem. And actually, the U.S. government's approach is better than that of, say, the U.K., Canada, Australia. But it's getting worse and worse. There's more and more of these cases happening all the time. While we've done a pretty good job at putting down hostage taking of organizations like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, we haven't done so well in terms of these foreign adversaries, usually authoritarian governments, taking Americans prisoner, putting them through a judicial process that is opaque and not based in the rule of law as we know it. And so we're trying to shift the conversation and get people to understand that these are not Americans being held for any crimes that they committed. They're being held as a tool by a foreign state to try and get something in return from the United States of America. And if we want to save those people from these terrible fates, we're going to have to engage in some kind of negotiations until the time that we have credible deterrence to stop this practice going forward. We don't have those deterrents in place right now.
You know, there's a scene in the documentary where I think it was a member of Congress who told the Shargi family, hey, you know, I don't think we're going to completely change our entire stance to Iran based on what we obviously want your husband back. I'm paraphrasing here, but that sort of clarity is rarely out in the open. I mean, what you hear from the State Department and other, we are trying our hardest, we're doing everything we can, but hey, guess what? There's this elephant in the room that we can't ignore.
I want to acknowledge that that was Congressman Ted Deutch from Florida, who has been one of the most vocal and committed advocates for hostage families, because one of his constituents, Bob Levinson, a former FBI agent, was abducted in Iran and never heard from again. Trump administration announced that it had intelligence that he had died while in Iranian custody in 2020. But the fact of the matter is very few representatives want to engage in these conversations. The fact that Congressman Deutch would be so honest and upfront about the challenges of it is admirable. And it also speaks to the kind of very difficult calculations that a government has to make. Ultimately, though, if a citizen's condition and freedom and safety are a concern, until we find ways to make this less attractive, it's going to keep happening, and we're going to have to give some kind of concessions to get people out. Historically, since the Nixon administration, the U.S. government has had a policy of no concessions. But that policy has been flouted on dozens of occasions in instances where the political cost here at home became too high to not freeing someone. You can see it in the U.K. right now in their freeing of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe and Amiche Oshuri. Those families had raised the cases of their loved ones for years until finally it came to a breaking point. But in the process, they left other Britons behind. This is a really treacherous business and one that while the U.S. government, the U.K. government, the Canadian government, the Australian government, Western European governments, they're not responsible for the hostage takings that these authoritarians are doing, but they are responsible for the safety, well-being, and freedom of their own citizens. That's what governments are for.
What kinds of disincentives can the United States government impose on a hostage-taking or detaining nation? I mean, you know, who do you penalize and who do you make life difficult for where they have an incentive to say, you know what, we should probably let him out?
We have, first of all, the global Magnitsky sanctions, which are part of international law now, sanctions that are targeted to individuals who are human rights violators and terrorism perpetrators. Hostage taking is one of those crimes by which you can go after officials of states who are involved in these events. You can seize their assets internationally. You can put red cards out for their arrest internationally. You can try them in international courts if they are detained. That's one. Another is freezing assets of governments and placing new sanctions on economies. I'm not a big fan of blanket sanctions on entire nations and their economies because, from experience, I've seen that they almost always hurt normal people more than they do the perpetrators of these crimes. But ultimately, it's going to keep happening until we have those measures in place, and those measures are shared by like-minded governments. We all have to come together and say, hey, you know what? This is not going to stand on our watch. Right now, in the negotiations between Iran and world powers, every single one of the Western countries, the United States, the UK, France, and Germany, along with Austria, the host nation of the JCPOA talks, have citizens being held hostage in Iran right now. I think it's a very compelling argument to say, Iran, we're not going to talk about lifting these sanctions until you clear the decks, free all these people, and stop this practice moving forward. Unfortunately, those governments have not come together and made that decision that that they're going to take that unified front. And for that reason, I'm worried that we're going to see a new spate of Iranian hostage taking in the not so distant future.
I cannot imagine any world in where, for example, if this was Steph Curry, if this was LeBron, that it wouldn't be on every newspaper above the fold every day for the entire time that Brittany Griner has been gone.
I agree with you 100%. I mean, I think the truth is, I mean, if you look at my case, you know, the Washington Post made it a matter of public record and kept a count on their website and in the print edition, writing stories about me. Same argument could be made. You know, maybe somebody worked at a smaller regional or local paper and was abducted in another country. Are they going to get the same attention? Probably not. All the more reason for me and people who have an understanding of what's at stake here and what is likely actually happening in this supposed case against her, all the more reason for us to be waving our arms and trying to shine a spotlight on it. I think that ultimately my great hope is that Brittany comes home very soon and that I have a chance to meet her and talk to her. In the cases of others, Americans who've been held wrongfully hostage by other governments, I never had one that I met after the fact that I reported on say, I wish you'd been quiet on my case.
Did you think that people did not care about you on the outside? Were you told that?
I was told that for weeks while I was being held in solitary confinement. The Iranian, my interrogator said that the Iranian state media had announced that my wife and I had been killed in a car accident and that people believed it. I had no way of knowing if that was true or not. They were also saying that I had access to legal representation, which was certainly not true. I didn't see a lawyer for the first 9 months of my detention. So, you know, it's a period that the first days are ones of confusion. Then that confusion becomes terror. you wonder if you're ever going to see the light of day again. You wonder if you're going to be executed. And then as time drags on, you wonder if you're going to die in prison. And you know, your fears, your apprehensions, your anxieties shift multiple times during one of these ordeals. And in every single way, it's inhumane and it's torture to create those circumstances by which captors are trying to really make the detainee go mad.
Jason Rezaian of the Washington Post, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ari.
Just awful for anyone involved in that kind of inhumane treatment. And that is it for now. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.